I'm Nancy Wood. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Nancy.
It's good to be here. Gosh, that sounds, am I sounding real loud? It does to me. I want to thank the board for asking me to talk. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here to speak to you this weekend. This is what I like to call God's country when you go to the mountains. You know, it's just so beautiful. And I'm grateful to be a part of it. My home group is Traditions Group. It is the best group in Memphis. And my sobriety date is November 11th, 1990. And it's through God's grace and the people of this program that I'm sober today. And I'll always be grateful for that. I'm a little bit nervous, and this will pass, so bear with me, please. Just before I came to the meeting, I always have a little prayer and meditation before I speak. And I just opened the big book up and I started looking at what I turned to. And what I read was about the stories in the back of the book and how it's about finding a power. This is all about finding a power greater than ourselves that can keep us sober and finding, and that the stories are everyone's personal opinion. So it reminded me that I was able to come up here tonight and tell you that whatever I say does not necessarily represent Alcoholics Anonymous, but it is just my story and my opinion and how it's worked for me. I was born in Memphis and raised there. I'm from a small family. I have one older brother. And this older brother had a burning bush experience when he was very young. And really, it's probably one of my oldest memories. My brother, from that time on, always knew that he wanted to be a preacher. And he was kind of set apart from everybody, treated real special. He was a very gifted person as far as spiritually, I guess. Everybody thought he was something really special, but I was a sister and I didn't think he was. And he was just my brother, and we fought like other kids. But I was very jealous of the attention that he got. And I felt different. And I tell you what, the way I felt when I was growing up was that all of y'all knew something that I didn't know. It was like y'all knew that one thing that it was like you had a secret that you just weren't sharing with me, and I didn't know how to get it. And I just felt so different from everybody. I always did. And I felt like I looked different from everybody. I remember when I was 14, my mother gave me one of those home perms, and I had an afro before its time. You know, I was really weird looking. And then later it came in style. Maybe I started it. I don't know. But, I was real flat-chested, and I always wanted to just, be really big and have blonde hair and blue eyes. And of course, that was never going to happen. And but that was when I drank, it happened. But anyway, it didn't happen for me. But anyway, so as I was growing up, I had this brother to compete with, and he usually won out. So I got the attention in a different way. He got it in the good way, I got it in the bad way, and I'm sure this is the same old story most of you have. But I'm a late bloomer. I didn't start drinking until I was 21. In fact, it was my 21st birthday. So, and that's next week. My birthday's next week, and I'll be 50. And I tell Robert, we were driving in town, there's a big sign on the street, and it says, Happy 50th Birthday. And I said, well, how did they know? So, I'm not feeling real good about that birthday. Anyway, when I was growing up, I just hung around with a lot of kids that rebelled. And I grew up in the 60s, and I heard all the things that I was attracted to, that the glamour of the wild side, I guess. And When I turned 15, my body started to develop. I started to change. I had gotten braces on my teeth. My looks improved. And I got an interest in boys. And, you know, it's just like most teenage girls. I wanted a boyfriend, and I thought that would be the answer to all my problems. And I spotted this guy on the football field one day, and he was the guy that I just was going to get, and I did. And this guy was so sick. He was already an alcoholic, and I will tell you that I have his permission to call him an alcoholic. I just don't call people alcoholics. And he is still an active drinker, and in fact, he is on a transplant list for a new liver. So I can tell you for sure that, you know, it'll get you. And anyway, I spotted this guy on the football field, and I had to have him, and I went after him, and I got him, and I got pregnant, and we got married, and just the typical woman story. And he drank. Well, the drinking just got progressive, and he was kind of a violent drunk. He was an Apache Indian, and he'd get that fire water in him, and he'd just go to beating on me, and, you know, that progressed too. And I remember the first time I drank, I was 21, and we lived in Florida. And I'll tell you this, when I got married to this man, my mother had never made me iron anything. I never had to clean the house. I knew absolutely nothing about cooking. I did not know how to be a wife to this man. And I resented everything that that he did. He would, you know, go out drinking and leave me home alone with the baby. I knew nothing about, I'd never babysat, never, didn't know nothing about being a mother. And I just was doing the best I could under the circumstances. And they weren't very good. But he would, on my 21st birthday, I was living in Florida. They had those drive-through liquor stores. I don't know if they still have them, but you could drive up and couldn't wait to be carded. You know, I had never gone out and bought any alcohol before and got there, and they didn't even card me. You know, I was kind of disappointed about that, but went home, and I had one or two drinks, and I think I drank it straight, and I went into a blackout, and I woke up the next day, and I had thrown up in every room of the house, and I had a great big fat lip where he had told me that if I threw it one more time, he was going to bust me one, and naturally, I had thrown up one more time, and he busted me one. Worst hangover I can remember ever having was that next day, and I cleaned all that mess up myself, because, of course, he was unable to, or wouldn't, I don't know which, but that was how my drinking started, was that night. And I left him, and I moved back to Memphis after a good beating one night. And he came back to Memphis, and we got back together, and it was for 7 years like that, off and on. We had a total of 3 kids. And when the third child was born and she was 2 weeks old, he came in one night, and he was in a blackout. And he was in and out of that Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde personality. And this was the last night that I lived with him, and it was a terrible night for me. The man wanted to kill me. And he tried many ways to do this, but he burned me, and he would choke me, and he stabbed me, was what he did the last night. That was the last thing before he passed out. And I just called the ambulance. I didn't call the police, I called an ambulance, and they called the police. And they asked me if I wanted to have him arrested. I said yes. It's the first time I'd ever done that. It was the first time I ever stood up to him, and it was freeing. And I hated him. I mean, it was either he was going to kill me or I was going to kill him eventually, because I fantasized about it a lot and really, really hated this man. By the time this third child was born, and I did not want to have this baby, I was pregnant with her, I wanted to have an abortion, but I had no money. and no one would help me. And I moved back home with my mom and my dad, and that's when things got bad for me. And I started drinking, and I would go after work to drink with the people that I worked with, and I loved everything about it. I loved the way it made me feel, the courage that it gave me to be someone different, and I could just be anything I wanted to be or anybody I wanted to be. And it wasn't long, and the big book says that it doesn't take a woman long to become an alcoholic. It doesn't take us near the time it takes a man. And I was very, very active, and it got to the point where nobody wanted to go out and drink with me. And I did go to some very, very sordid places. And I don't even want to tell people who my friends were today. They were so bad. But I was one of them. And also about this time, I got involved in taking this little black pill that was real beautiful. And I would take it in the morning to get through the day, and then of course you can't go to sleep, so you have to drink to come down off of it. And I became addicted to that drug. And the only reason I mentioned that, I want you to know, is I don't consider myself to be a drug addict, really, because I was able to walk away from drugs on my own. I never needed any help with that. I cold turkey drugs, actually. And but again, alcohol helped me get through that. And when it came time for me to give up my drinking, that was not something I could do alone. But I got into that vicious cycle, and I got into a state of mind, and the only way I can describe it is it was paranoia. And I lived in a state of paranoia. I thought everybody was out to get me. And at one point, I thought that the mob was out to get me, and I didn't know anybody in the mob, and I don't know where that came from, but I really believed it. And I got on an airplane and abandoned my kids, just left them with my mom, and took off. And I went to this, I kind of went underground, that's what I like to call it, because actually that's what it was. I moved to a real small town in Colorado, and everybody there was waiting on the statute of limitations to run out so they could go back home. You know? So that's those were my friends. And I got into some other things, but drinking was always a big part of that. The first job I got was in a bar. I worked 18 miles from where I lived, and I had to hitchhike to get there. And that's pretty scary. You know, you get off at 2 o'clock in the morning, And it's kind of like being out here, and you don't know who you're going to get in the car with, because everybody at that time of the morning is pretty drunk. So, you know, I'm grateful to be alive today, because those are some really small, curvy roads in the mountains. And they're not quite, they're a lot bigger mountains than they are here, and I survived that. I remember one time I got in the car with some strangers, and made them pull over so I could go to the bathroom on the side of the road. Didn't know these people from anything. And got out and fell into cow manure. You know, it was a open range in the mountains. And then I'm going to get back in their car like that. You know, I can, some insane things that I did. But just, you know, crazy. And at one point, I even had some friends, you know, that died while I was there. And I got paranoid about the FBI coming after me, and decided it was time to make another geographical change and came back home. And when I came back home, I was pretty much stayed in for a while, because I just was afraid to look out the window or open the door or anything. So I was going to change. I was going to change myself. So I'm here to tell you that for the next 12 years, I tried to change me. And I did everything the big book says that we're going to do. I counted my drinks, And I changed brands. I drank only wine. I read inspirational books. Put myself in treatment one time. And none of these things worked. I'll tell you about my trip to treatment. I went to a high school reunion, met a guy that I had known 20 years before, and in a couple of months we got married again, and I thought I'd known him for 20 years, you know? So we decided we were going to get married and we were going to blend our families. He had two daughters that were teenagers. I had three kids that were teenagers, and we moved into this house, and we've got five teenagers, and they're all drinking. And the oldest one went in treatment, and that was his oldest one went in treatment, and his youngest one then went in treatment. My youngest one ended up in treatment, and I was having a nervous breakdown from all of this, and I went in treatment, and these people that were surrounding me were, I was not on the alcohol ward now. And there was this one girl that came up to me and she said, I've done some really bad things, but I'm not a bad person. I said, these people are not getting nothing out of me. And in 3 days I left because my secrets were deep and dark and I wasn't going to tell anybody about them. The things I knew about me were going to the grave with me. But they wouldn't let my daughter come home. My husband dumped me while I was there. And I had never been dumped before, but I had never really gone with anybody long enough to get dumped before, you know. And they wouldn't let my daughter come home, and she was in treatment 77 days. And they told me when I got my own place that she could come home, and I got my own place, and she came home. They told me to try Al-Anon. So I went to Al-Anon. They told me I needed to learn how to live with my little drunk daughter. And I went to Al-Anon. And yeah, that's really funny, isn't it? She needed to learn how to live with her drunk mama. And so I went to Al-Anon. They told me to try six meetings. I tried six. I tried. You know, the only thing about Al-Anon, and I love Al-Anon because they got me to AA, but they couldn't keep me sober, you know, and I needed to get sober. But I met a lot of great people in Al-Anon and AA, and one night I went to this dance, and this was really, I think that trip to treatment was really the beginning of my bottom. And I went to an AA dance to hear somebody that I knew to speak, and Robert was there, and he asked me to dance. We danced, and I gave him my number, and he called, and we went out to coffee. And we go out for coffee, and he's 6 years in AA then, and he says, I have to tell you something. And I said, well, okay. And he says, I've been in jail. And I said, all right. And he said, well, it wasn't for rape. And I was so glad. I was so glad. And then he told me what he was in jail for, and I didn't know what to say. And but we got along pretty good, and he asked me to go out with him to the zoo, and it took him 2 years to take me to the zoo. And that's kind of the way it's gone. So he would talk to me about his drinking, and I would talk to him about mine. And I had never done that before. And I was starting to get honest with myself. And that was scared me to death. So I decided to go to an AA meeting, and I was scared to go. I was scared to go alone. I didn't know what to expect. The only alcoholics besides myself that I really in my life growing up were my uncle, who was a derelict drunk who lived under bridges, and I mean that's what I thought an alcoholic was, you see. And that drunk husband I'd had who beat me and was mean, and those were the two alcoholics. Not to mention all the people that I had hung out with, but I didn't look at them like that, but I did my uncle and my ex-husband. So those to me were my examples, and I was scared. But I found a woman to go with me, and she was an alcoholic. She was a friend of a friend. And I went to my first meeting, and I couldn't tell you anything I heard that night. But I went back, and I wouldn't go to a meeting in my neighborhood. I went all the way out to Cordova, which was probably about 15 miles from where I lived, and because I didn't want to run into anybody I might know, or I didn't want anybody to recognize me. I had this thing about the label, you know, of being an alcoholic. And I ran into all these people I knew from high school out there. And I thought, this is ridiculous, I'm going back home. And so I started going to meetings in my area. And I heard a lot of good things, you know. Just, they told me to get a sponsor, and they told me to read the big book and go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and pray in the morning, pray at night, and ask God to help me. And so I started going to meetings, and I looked around for a sponsor, and I asked somebody to be my sponsor, wouldn't use them. So then I asked somebody else to be my sponsor, and I wouldn't use them. And finally, this lady told me that she wanted to be my sponsor, and I said, okay. So she was my sponsor, and she sponsored a lot of women. She sponsored 8 or 9 or 10 women. I can't remember the number, but we would go to her house every Sunday, and we would have a big book study. And really what it was, we would just kind of tell each other war stories, and we would talk about our drinking. And I learned a lot there. I learned a great deal from this woman. Actually, I learned that I had taken my drinking a lot farther than I had thought, and that there were people that didn't take it as far as me, because I, you know, kind of felt that I was a high-bottom drunk, and I really, to be honest with you, I'm really not. And I learned a great deal at those meetings. And one of the ladies, I was about 90 days sober, I guess, and one of the ladies, her mother died. And I had gotten kind of close to 2 or 3 of them. One lady and I had the same sobriety date, and this other lady was a few years older, and her mother had passed away, and we really liked her and wanted to go to the funeral. And the funeral was going to be held in Corinth, Mississippi. And I didn't know where it was, but my sponsor knew, and she said that I could ride with her. So I got in the car with her, and this other lady who had the same sobriety date as me, we got in the car, and we're driving along, and all of a sudden I'm noticing that there's something wrong with my sponsor. She's driving real fast, and then she's driving real slow. And we did not make the funeral. We did not get there in time for the funeral. But by the time we got there, we figured out that she was drunk, and it was a real scary situation I was in. So we get out of the car. Now, the other girl and I, we kind of have two different stories about this. Mine is we got out of the car, and hers is we were thrown out of the car. But I like to think that we got out of the car, and she drove off and left us there, and we didn't know anybody in this little town, and we had $2 and a calling card. And we are 90 days sober and probably not dressed appropriately yet. And have on high heels on a cold February day. And we're freezing and hungry and cold and scared. And I think we looked like a couple of hookers walking around this little town square. So I suggested that we go into the pharmacy and buy a couple of hot chocolates and use that calling card and start calling people from our home group. And I had tried to call Robert, and he was not home. And we called a lot of people, and I don't believe we reached him, but I believe we reached his wife first, and that would be Wanda. And she told us to wait there and call back. And when we called back, Leon had taken off work and wanted to know where we were. And I always get a little choked up when I tell this story, but Leon drove 100 miles to pick us up and save us. He rescued us that day. And he took us to get us something to eat. And he sat there and he 12-stepped me. And I like to call him my Abby Thatcher, because just like Bill Wilson, he sat across from the table from me and brought me the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll always love Leon for that. And so Leon sponsored me for a little while and helped me get through some of the steps. And I had actually not really taken them, kind of called myself doing that, but had not. But and that's really what I like to talk about when I tell my story, are the steps. That's what I go to the treatment centers to do, is to bring them my program of recovery, which are the 12 steps. And I like to talk about the first step because I have no power over anything. And that was probably one of the hardest things I had to discover for myself. I knew my life was unmanageable, but I didn't like giving up control, and I really thought that that's what I was going to have to do. I couldn't imagine my life with or without alcohol, and I was grateful to discover that I had no power over it. And when I learned that, I was on the right road. Now, on the second step, you know, I think the big book's purpose is to help me find a power greater than myself so that I can get sober. And I was an agnostic. I call myself an agnostic because I had turned my back on that God that I grew up with. My brother, I always felt was so special, and that God liked him more than me anyway. And I just did my own thing all my life. And I didn't know how I was going to find a power greater than myself that I could have a relationship with. I had never had a relationship with a power like that. Never had I tried to get close to God. Never had I wanted to get close to God. And kind of like Robert says, I won't have anything to do with you if you won't have anything to do with me. I'll just do my own thing. And now, where do you start when you have nothing? But they told me that I had to find a power and that I could use anything. So what I decided to do was use my home group because I had nothing else to use. And my home group was actually worked real well for me. God talked to me through all the people in that group. And there was one man in particular, and a lot of y'all from Memphis know him, Larry G. And he would go to my first home group, which was the airport group. And he would go to that group, and I would talk in a meeting, and he would scold me every time I talked. And it would hurt my feelings so bad. And I would go home, and I would call Robert crying, and he'd hang up on me. And he would... That hurt my feelings, too. And he would say, call your sponsor, you know. And he forced me to do what I had to do for me. But I stayed sober to spite Larry G for a long time. And I went up and thanked him one time for helping me stay sober, and I know he didn't know what I was talking about. But I really appreciate him today. But I used my home group as my higher power, and my relationship with God grew from that. And I did what y'all told me to do, which was to get up in the morning and ask God to keep me sober and thank him at night if I made it through the day. And when I was about 2 years sober, I realized why I had stayed sober. So I say I'm so hard-headed, it took me 2 years to figure it out. And I can remember sitting in a meeting when I was about 2 years sober, and it dawned on me what people meant by, "But for the grace of God go I," or "through God's grace." And the people of this program sober today. It took me 2 years to figure that out. I had thought I was so smart. I had a lot of these aha experiences. But my higher power started from using my home group, and I still depend on God to talk to me through these people. So it is true that the grace of God and the people of the program are what have kept me sober. And the third step, of course, is letting go and letting God. And that was extremely difficult to do because I liked trying to control everything and still do, as Ro told me today. And I think Milton probably is the one that helped me the most there, because he pulled me aside after a meeting one night when I was whining about my daughter, and talked to me about it and gave me some good suggestions on how to let go, and it worked for me. And so a lot of people have influenced me in my steps through the years. But I did let Leon go because I felt it was important that I have a woman sponsor. And I have to tell y'all quickly this about my sponsors. I got a woman sponsor who was wonderful. She was from Florida, actually. She was such a lovely woman and had such good sobriety. And she decided to divorce her husband and move back. And so I got another woman who I thought was so wonderful, and she left me and went to New Mexico, and I was scared to ask anybody else. I had already had two sponsors drink on me, and by that time, and I had this starting to have this thing about the fear of rejection and abandonment, and so I wouldn't ask anybody, but I did meet a woman that I adopted as my sponsor, and I just use her as my sponsor, because I'm scared if I tell her or ask her, somehow God will take her out of my life. Sick thinking, see, I still have it. And but she's been my sponsor now for 5 or 6 years. And I met her when Robert was going through chemotherapy. Robert had colon cancer, and I think I was 2 or 3 years sober. So we walked down that road together, and that was just my little sponsor story. I thought I'd throw that out there for you. And back to the steps. So before I left Leon, I had to do a fourth and fifth step, and I didn't like doing the fourth step because I kept looking at the fifth step. I didn't want to tell anybody. I talked to you earlier about those things, those secrets that I wanted to take with me to the grave, and there were really two of them that were real bad. And I told one of them in my fifth step. The other one I was just not going to tell in my fifth step. But God was so good to me and loved me so much that he put a woman in my life who had done the same thing, and she blurted it out to me one day about this thing that she had done. And I just wanted to fall on my knees and praise God at that moment, because it was so spiritual for me that someone else had done this horrible thing. And I hugged her and we talked, and I got to tell that and get that out of me. That was one of those miracles for me. Because the big book tells me if I don't tell it all, I might get drunk. And I'm scared enough of alcohol that I needed to tell it all. But that's one of my healthy fears today. And the sixth step, boy, if I start talking about my character defects, I'll keep you here all night, so I'm going to kind of skip over that. I'll mention a few. I'm selfish, self-centered, lazy, proud. Yeah. Y'all know them. You know how we are. And they get in my way a lot of times, you know, and kind of rule me sometimes. But thank God for the program, because there's always somebody that can bring me back to reality and tell me what's up, like Ro did today. And we had a nice little conversation, and he kind of pointed some things out to me today. So still working for me. And, you know, I took the seventh step prayer. I was ready for God to take all those things away from me. And I had my eighth step done when I did my fourth step, and it was time for me to make some amends. And here again, you know, God steps in and does it for me. I had a grandmother that I could not stand. I did not want to be around her. I wanted her to grow old and die alone, because I had resented her so much for the way she treated me when I was younger. And she was very mean to me, and that's just, you know, she just was. And she had a stroke and couldn't talk and had to go to a nursing home. She was 90-something years old, and I knew I needed to make an amends to her, and I didn't know how I was going to do it. I knew it needed to be done, and I was sponsoring a couple of girls at the time, and one of the girls that I sponsored had a problem she wanted to talk about, and it started stirring up all these feelings inside about this resentment I had toward my grandmother, and it started coming to the surface that I needed to make an amends to this lady. And there was another girl I sponsored who wanted to get with me to start doing her steps. And we could never seem to get together. And finally I said, I'm coming to where you work. I'm going to pick you up and take you home. We're going to do the step then. I said, where do you work? She worked at the nursing home where my grandmother was. And, you know, that was just another one of those miracles God put in my life so I can make this amends, because I have to clean my side of the street. And those are the sort of things that happened to me. I had to make an amends to that first husband who stabbed me, and I could not for the life of me see what my part in it was. And I had been sober, I don't know, a year or so maybe, and when he called me out of the blue, and for some reason, in a flash, God revealed to me everything I had done, and he put the words in my mouth, and they just flowed out, and I made my amends. And it was another miracle of this program, that God loves me and this program works. So that's kind of how my amends have gone. I was talking about this sometime yesterday or today, where after I had been sober a little while, I got a letter from a collection agency on a bill I had owed 21 years before, and I had to go make some financial amends. And they took the money. I was so disappointed. You know, I thought, I'm going to go make this amends, and I'm going to, surely, you know, after 21 years, they're going to, but they took it. And it was okay, you know, but I really didn't want to. But that, you know, those are my amends. And then I maintained my sobriety with 10, 11, and 12. And, where I'm at today, I'm still dating Robert. I've been dating him since before I got sober, and he finally proposed a few months ago, and we set a date for March 3rd, 3300. We decided his third marriage, my third marriage, and no more, so we thought that was a perfect date. It works out, doesn't it? I told you a little bit that I had three kids. I'd like to mention them. I know when Milton talks, he says his kids tell him they love him, and it doesn't get any more spiritual than that. I remember when my son told me that he loved me for the first time after I got sober. He was leaving the country. He was moving to Korea. And It was the first time that I could remember him telling me he loved me. And it was, our relationship blossomed from that. He's back in the States now. He doesn't live too far from here, actually. And we have a good relationship today, and he calls me a lot and still tells me he loves me. My oldest daughter lives in Virginia Beach, and all three kids have two kids each, but I have a little blonde-haired, blue-eyed granddaughter, and thought God had a real good sense of humor when he gave me that one. And she has two little girls, and she's married to a man who's career Navy, and they have a good life, and they're doing real well. She's a nurse, not an alcoholic. My son is not an alcoholic that I know of, not yet. And he's married and has two children. My youngest daughter, the one that went to treatment when she was 14, when she turned 17 years old, I had to ask her to leave my home because she wouldn't work and she wouldn't go to school. And I had to ask her to leave because I was scared I wouldn't stay sober with her there. And she left, and she became a deadhead. She was traveled all over the country, and I never knew where she was, if she was alive or dead. She would show up every once in a while. She'd have head lice, and she'd be real filthy and skinny and no shoes on. She lived in the, they would dig their latrines. I mean, she lived a filthy life, and she was absolutely a drug addict and alcoholic. And I couldn't let go of her. Here's my letting go story. I couldn't let go of her, and I didn't know. Prayed for her constantly, and I decided that, God loved me. How can I love her like God loves her? Because I know God loves her too. So what I decided to do was do the best I could to love her, let her know that I loved her. And when she would show up, I would allow her to bathe and eat. She could not stay there, but she could bathe and eat. And I would hug her and tell her I love her and send her on her way and continue to pray. And she got pregnant and she drank. And I threatened to take her child away from her. And that's when she started getting sober. And she had 3 years in April. So prayer does work. And, my life is good today. I am a homeowner, and I have a job and a car, and I don't look out the window thinking people are after me anymore. I'm not afraid to answer my telephone. I'm happy, joyous, and free. And I have friends all over the country and the world today. And a lot of them are right here tonight. And I'm so grateful that you you've been such a good listener. And I thank you so much for allowing me to speak.